Hello and welcome back to another edition of Editing Aloud. And it's all Asia and China and BRICS this week. We have had a, we were in the middle of a summit. We've got some of the leaders of the world's biggest economies in Johannesburg. We have Vladimir Putin, who is not the leader of one of the world's biggest economies, but a powerful man nonetheless. Xi Jinping, who is leader of one of the world's biggest economies. The president of Brazil. And the president of India, all being hosted by President Cyril Ramaphosa at the BRICS summit. So it's an apposite time panel to talk about what President Ramaphosa has been doing for the past few weeks, which has been, if you read the news headlines, he's been sort of raising money. He was in the Middle East a week or so ago. He raised $10 billion in, promise of $10 billion investment in Saudi Arabia, another $10 billion in the UAE. And President Xi Jinping has arrived in South Africa for a summit, his own summit and then the BRICS summit, with a promise to invest $14.7 billion in South Africa. And Sikonathi Mantshantsha, what do these people mean when they talk about, you know, because nobody says what it's for. It's just a sort of pledge. How do you, does it mean anything? Is it real?
It does mean quite a lot. It is real in the event that indeed they can find a deal or agree on a particular deal. Let's take the Chinese, for example. Yeah. There's a company called Beijing Automotive Industries, which has a plant in Guha. White people call it Guha. Down in the Eastern Cape, they've invested about 10 billion rands there.
Is it up and running, that plant?
It is up and running. You see their trucks and some other vehicles on the roads in South Africa. So that's inward investment coming from a brick. But President Xi Jinping has now come in. Xi Jinping has come in and said, we'll give a loan of $2.4 billion to Eskom, a loan which amounts to about 33 billion rands. And there's another 14.7 billion rands, which as yet there's no detail about. And there's no detail about all of these other, which now amount to $35 billion, according to the Sowetan, almost 470 billion rand over the past month, which is exactly 50% of the target at 100 billion rand. So there's progress.
$100 billion that he's looking for.
Yeah, $100 billion, yeah. Thank you. So there is indeed a lot of progress.
Yeah.
What we don't yet have are the specific contracts, the specific investments in which the monies will go.
And presumably, Patrick Bulger, because they are investments, the implication of that is that they would require a return on. So they're investing money in South Africa to make a profit out of it, not necessarily as an act of charity.
Absolutely. Of course, it's an investment. I mean, South Africa is, to my understanding, is in quite a unique sort of place in BRICS, in that it's not there entirely on economic grounds alone.
Yeah.
So obviously there's a sort of geopolitical, there's a strategic calculation as to why to include South Africa. You know, obviously I would think for the Chinese, it's, you know, it's not a great deal of money by Chinese standards. You know, obviously Eskom, they need every cent they can get, and you know, and hopefully this will go some way towards sort of stabilizing.
They've still got to pay it back.
They've still got to pay it back, obviously, and, you know, they've got to squeeze it out of us to get it to pay it back.
Yeah.
But I think for China, obviously, in particular, through the BRICS prism, they're really looking at South Africa as, I mean, South Africa is the prize in Africa.
Yeah.
You know, it's the gateway to Africa. It's the sort of, it's the, you know, one of the two stronger economies on the continent. And to the extent...
You've got to be here.
And, you know, even within BRICS, you must imagine, there would be some competition, one would imagine, between the Chinese and the Russians as to, you know, who exactly has got the
who has
the upper hand.
Who has us by the throat.
In South Africa.
Yeah. Ray Hartley, there's a piece in the Sowetan where Rob Davies, the trade and industry minister, complains that South Africa is not getting as much out of BRICS as it's putting in. I don't know whether you've read it, but he says, inward quantum investment to SA by BRICS between 2003 and 2017 was a mere $18 billion. It's in sharp contrast to the $60 billion outward investment by SA to BRICS countries. Is there harmony in BRICS? It's not something we cover as closely as we should, I think, in the South African media. We don't know the internal workings of it, but that's an interesting number.
It is an interesting number, but it's almost doubled overnight with the Chinese announcement. I think what's very good for South Africa is that we're part of the up-and-coming bloc. You know, you had this G7 meeting not long ago.
Yeah.
It disintegrated into, they couldn't agree on the pledge. The G7 doesn't have Russia, it doesn't have China, it doesn't have India.
Mm.
And it's becoming increasingly irrelevant. You know, the Chinese economy grows by the size of Italy every 2 years.
Mm.
So to have some kind of power body called the G7 that doesn't include China, never mind India, Russia, is crazy. And it's very, very fortunate for us that we have the strategic pivot of being in Africa, that we're in this body and that we have influence. And we have a lot of time. You know, these leaders have their summits, they spend a lot of time together.
Yeah.
There's one-on-one meetings between all of the parties at each of these summits. There's a lot of time to actually work on an investment agenda and to deal with the concerns that Rob Davies has.
Sure.
And the power of that whole group, Peter, just context, we have the second biggest economy, China, in the world. We've got India, the sixth biggest economy, that has just replaced France, which is in the G7.
Yeah.
So we really have the largest economies in the world in here, in that club. It is only
Do you think, Stimbiso, that the club, even though it's big and even though it's powerful, still has to sort of prove itself in some way, though? I mean, what is it? What's it there for? Is it simply to facilitate investment between its own members, or does it develop over time real political clout in the world?
I think it develops over time, but the problem for us from the South African perspective, I think, over the past decade, has been that we didn't know what we wanted to achieve by being members of BRICS.
Yeah.
There were a lot of complaints about, okay, South Africa may be spending money, but we're not coming up with any proposals. At some stage, there was complete confusion where some in government were speaking as if it's going to be a replacement for IMF and all these other institutions, for instance, to create a BRICS bank. So I think we need to come back from that position where South Africa tended to see it as some kind of an anti-imperialist formation, which it is not.
Yeah.
Instead of just looking at
China, this is a trade organization
that we're supposed to be working with.
Yeah.
So I think with the current president, it's possible that he will look at it as a vehicle to deal with economic issues rather than as some political institution that it is not.
And how much good does it do Cyril Ramaphosa to be able to come back and say, I've got 10 billion from the Saudis, 10 billion from the Emirates, and 14.7 billion from China? I mean, it's not real yet, it's just a promise.
Yes, I think it's like in those early Mandela years where he was going across the world and he was getting all these pledges from everyone. It gives people some level of confidence.
Yeah.
But even within the ANC, remember that some of the people who were opposed to him were saying when he comes in, he'll pull South Africa out of BRICS and make us more friendly to the West instead of that developing world.
Yeah.
So I think this just puts an end to that conspiracy.
Puts an end to that. Fortunately, that Donald Trump has made that inevitable as well.
Well,
Sukunati, one of the problems with Chinese investment, particularly from the state as opposed to the Chinese private sector, is that it often involves building infrastructure, right? So there are two stories going around the world at the moment. One is in Sri Lanka, where the Chinese built a huge port and city, rather like Ngoga, and the Sri Lankans were unable to pay for it, so they've taken it back, and they literally now own, rather like Russia had to sell Alaska to the US, they own a bit of Sri Lanka. The Chinese are also lending lots of money, $62 billion investments into Pakistan as part of their Belt and Road initiative. As the Pakistani national debt increases, their ability to service the investments the Chinese have made also begins to suffer. So there's a new super transit in Lahore, a rail system that they're unable to pay for, and the Chinese want their money back. How do we ensure that we don't get into that kind of trouble with these guys?
Well, you can only engineer the transactions in a manner that first generates the ability to pay back the money. So if money goes into Eskom, it must not be stolen so that Eskom isn't then unable to pay back.
Yeah.
If money goes into our railways, which fortunately we don't need the Chinese assistance there, it must be money. It's like you said, Ilya, it's not a gift, it's an investment. Mm. We must put money to put into hard assets, which will then generate a return. That's the only way to avoid being colonized again by the Chinese this time.
Because Patrick, what has tended to happen with that Chinese investment in Africa until now is that they've been very happy to build big airports and sort of glitter projects. You get a nice airport, you get a new presidential palace in some countries, but there's no return on any of those things. So it's not a health program, it's not an education program where you actually get, so you get some workers involved. Chinese workers build the palace, they build the airport, and then they leave again. How does that change here? How do we make them do it our way and still get their money?
Well, I think the one thing is in realizing I think South Africa is in a strong position. Obviously we have a lot of what the world wants. Africa in particular has what China wants, which is land for agriculture. Mm. And I think the danger was that the sort of ideological motives would somehow trump the financial and the economic, and we'd be so keen to sort of be in this bloc, as Thembiso mentioned, as a kind of anti-imperialist bloc, that we might neglect looking after our own interests. And I think the one feature, if you look at the Chinese investments, they don't really have this sort of established, mature companies that. Mm. That can do the sort of investments that one might like from the West, where you get the sort of technology transfer and et cetera. So the cynical view is that a lot of the Chinese investment is geared around the extraction machinery, basically. Mm. So this is about extracting, it's about extracting minerals, and it's about, in their mind, hopefully one day, about sort of extracting a lot of food and sort of agricultural produce. So I guess we've just got to the extent that we can, is absolutely stand our ground.
Yeah.
Read the small print, and realize that there is no free lunch.
Ray, can we do that? Can we stand up to people like China? I mean, we need the money.
Well, we can if we pay back our loans and pay back our debts. If we don't, then they're going to want equity, and then a certain portion of our utilities will be owned by the Chinese, and they're very, very good and very effective at moving in with a state-related company or leadership or management and sorting that thing out.
Yeah.
I don't think China wants to be involved in coal-fired power stations in South Africa. I have a feeling this is, a particular need that South Africa has right now. And China recognizes that by giving this relatively small loan, it can actually make a lot of mileage with South Africa and relieve pressure in an institution which is at the core of the economic problem.
Good. Well, we'll be back with you to continue this conversation after this break. Welcome back. Thembiso, the ANC last weekend held elective conferences in two provinces, Gauteng and KwaZulu-Natal, which seemed, on the face of it, to go Cyril Ramaphosa's way. I say on the face of it because I know that there were lots of other questions behind, but what was your take on how well he did out of that weekend?
I think he wasn't that much of a factor. It makes life easy for him for the next couple of years.
Yeah.
But it means nothing for him post the ANC conference in 2022. because what has happened is that there's been a realignment, not of Zuma versus Cyril forces,
yes.
But it is, well, they try to make it a generational thing,
yeah.
But it's a group of younger ANC leaders who feel that it's time they push out the older generation.
But isn't it interesting? I mean, anybody come in on this? Because they are younger.
Yes.
I don't know who owes what to whom, but there is suddenly a generational change at that provincial level. And does it? You say it means nothing post the 2022 provincial.
It's not guaranteed.
Does he get a second term out of these guys?
He's not guaranteed from these guys because they may be pushing for their own candidate. This campaign actually had started. I think some 2-3 years ago,
yeah.
It failed, and they started again. They tried at Nasrec,
yeah.
And it failed. They didn't get any nominations. But what looks like is happening is that they're trying to win the provinces because they saw what happened at Nasrec is that if you control provincial structures of the ANC,
yeah.
You have a chance of making
it. But when you say they, are they one thing, or is it a disparate number of
people? But what brings them together is that they were once leaders of the ANC youth league.
Okay.
So what you may find in 2022 is that either Fikile Mbalula or Malusi Kigaba will then have a chance of being a member of the top six if they're not running for the deputy presidency or the president.
Yeah.
But it's not clear now which names are being supported.
Right, because around about 20 of the new KZN PEC of 32 people are ex-Youth League.
Yes.
And that matters.
Yes, and people will look at them and say most of these people supported Zuma. Yes, they supported Zuma in 2009, and they supported Zuma when the ANC went to its conference in 2012. But then they were divided last year, and they've come together again. So their agenda seems to be beyond Cyril or Zuma.
Yeah.
Their agenda is about, this is our time to now take over the leadership.
And are they more radical or less radical? Where are they on the political spectrum?
That's where it's more frustrating, especially in KZN, because their politics is not clear at all.
Okay.
At least here in Gauteng, when you look at the guy who's now the new ANC secretary, you would say he's more on the left of the current ANC leadership.
Yeah.
But when you look at the person who was the face of their campaign, is very much conservative, Lebogang Mahaeng.
Yeah.
So he's very much conservative on the issues of the economy. So it's a mix. I think what just unites them is that their former youth leaguers, they think they are the only ones who can stop the ANC from coming out of power and handing over to EFF.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Ray, if you were the EFF, you'd be worried about what just happened at the weekend. And if Stambiso is right, and this is a new, you know, resurgence, or not a resurgence, but a surgence of former Youth League people in the ANC doing well in elections, thinking clearly and planning and strategizing, suddenly the party, you can see the party 4 or 5 years down the road, where it was difficult 6 months ago.
Yeah, I think the ANC needs this injection of some new leadership. And the fact that Panyaza Lesufi is now the deputy chair in Gauteng, there's a new face that, you know, is suddenly on the national stage. But I think that, you know, the electoral politics remains skewed against the youth.
Mm.
So the rate of registration of young voters in the 25 and under category is very, very low. And if the ANC gets enough momentum to actually get young people to go and register, something which the EFF has failed to do, they might find a new constituency. That constituency, however, you know, is highly contested. I don't think the EFF's going to give it up very easily.
Yeah.
And they've kind of got a head start with young voters. So it could be very, very interesting to see if these young people actually enter formal politics and register where they would vote.
Well, that's what has to happen, doesn't it, Patrick? I mean, both the EFF and the ANC will now be chasing between now and whenever the election is. How many more registration days are there? One or two, I think, right? One in January?
Well, it's pitifully few.
So you need, I don't know how many votable or voting age people are unregistered, but it's in the millions. I mean, that's got to be a huge factor in our politics, Patrick.
Absolutely, and looking at a sort of a younger ANC in the years to come. I mean, obviously, that's going to take, I would think, a lot of steam from the EFF train. But the one thing I think is going to emerge is, and the question that is what sort of politics? And Simbiso is saying that it's kind of unclear. But I would think that we're quite possibly heading towards a younger and a more conservative ANC. Mm. And which might seem a contradiction, in that one would think the young people are necessarily more radical, but I get the feeling with the, and especially if you look at the school system, I know around my area I see the young guys in the schools and they're very they're very upright and they're very proper and they maybe
pragmatic rather than conservative.
Absolutely.
Let's find things that work.
Possibly, they look like people who are kind of serious about kind of what they want to achieve in life and sort of get a decent life with all the sort of middle class trappings and whatever. So I wouldn't be surprised actually if we find an ANC that, as you say, is pragmatic, is ideologically a more conservative. Yeah. Than what the EFF is pretending to be.
It'd be pointless running the same sort of ideological.
One quick thing there is that what I noticed over the weekend, which I thought was quite interesting, is that in all the previous ANC conferences, you will have a percentage of leaders who came from trade unions. There's no one anymore.
There's nothing.
Other than Mike Mabuya Kulu, who was in the unions like 30 years ago in KZN. Yeah. There's no one anymore.
In fact, there was a big meeting over the weekend of sort of left-wing organizations, including some of the unions, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh, yes, the VAVI meeting. Somewhere. Yes, I saw that meeting convened by VAVI. But in the ANC itself, it looks like they've been completely disseminated. Yeah.
Before we run out of time, we must talk about Eskom, Sikonathi. So it's produced these results. It's got, what, 3 billion net loss last year, 19 billion rand misspent since 2012. Why 2012 and not 2011 or whatever, but pick a number, pick a date. And suddenly 33 billion rand from the Chinese, one of the Chinese banks. I presume the 33 billion rand will go straight into debt servicing.
Yes, Eskom is paying 41.5 billion rand in interest a year. Now that's 3 years worth of money to build Kusile power station. The 2.3 billion rand loss is not a big deal. The real deal is, what are we doing? What is Eskom doing to restructure itself so that it does not have to go borrow money every year in order to pay debt?
Yeah.
Borrowing from Paul to pay Sikonathi and Sitembiso to pay John. That's the fundamental thing. And the management of Eskom and the board have said they will address that question starting in September. Of course, the big elephant in the room is that the bloated structure. When I talk about the bloated structure, I'm talking about indeed this bloated balance sheet where they heavily relied on debt, but on the other hand, and the more painful one, job losses. They have said on the record they've got 33% more people than they need. That talks about 12,000 people.
Eskom's always run on debt. I mean, it's been the debt management has been the great skill at Eskom. It used to raise money in the bond market and now raises money directly from institutions like banks because it's easier to do it that way. But
Peter, that on its own has never been a problem until the debt went beyond a certain threshold where Eskom is able to then meet its own obligations without external help, without Ntlantlana dropping in more of our money.
I think it was Paul Mashatile the other day who I heard describing a three-way split for a new Eskom into transmission, distribution. What was it? Transmission, generation,
and distribution.
And distribution. I don't quite know the difference
is
between
distribution. The proposal that was there back in the early 2000s.
1998.
Oh, the Reds.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, so somebody's hauled that document out of a drawer, right?
It was there many years ago.
But can the ANC hold a solid conversation on splitting up ESCOM and just getting on ahead and doing it? Or do the unions suddenly come into the picture and stop
it? I think that this is the core of the problem, is that Ramaphosa's constituency remains within those trade unions. They're the people who brought him to power, who played a big role, the first backers. And he cannot afford to alienate them because he doesn't have enough other options within the ANC. And I personally think Eskom is going to go to the consumer and push up prices to try and deal with this problem rather than deal with its bloated staff and its overpaid staff.
And the biggest thing here now, exactly on that point, Ray, these are the people who talk about monopoly, white monopoly.
Yeah.
But their definition of monopoly is not the real definition of monopoly. Here's one chance for all those people who complain about white monopoly capital and everything to dismantle this one big monopoly that's holding South Africa
back.
Yes, the people's monopoly. Let's deal with the people's monopoly. Dismantle the thing into three pieces and give it to the people.
Quickly, there are people whispering in my ear. We're running out of time. The PRC, now, Nhlanhla Nene, the finance minister, is meeting the PRC board, I think, tomorrow, yeah? And he's going to sort it out, and after he's said his word, then all of this fighting around Dan Machila, the chief investment officer, CEO at the same time, does that all go away?
No, it depends, of course, what he does. The most important thing, the chairman, Mr. Kungubele, who is Nhlanhla Nene's deputy, is diametrically opposed to Nhlanhla Nene and to the board.
Yeah.
So you've got the minister on the one hand, together standing with the board and with Daniel Machila. You've got the deputy minister standing with three other directors against the whole board. Nhlanhla Nene's solution should be to resolve that problem.
Yeah.
Are we guys together or are we not? Some of you have to leave. Claudia Manning has already left, resigned last week. Nhlanhla Nene then will have to make a decision. Does Monhle Kungubele remain a board director at the PIC, and does he remain chairman of the PIC?
Because the deputy finance minister is always both of those things.
Not by law.
Not by law.
Not by law. Tradition. Anyone can be chairman, but traditionally they have always put a politician there
but
as chairman.
But what would be the implications of him saying he's removing?
There's no implications. The finance minister appoints and fires the directors of the board.
So he can even fire the deputy.
He can fire the deputy and put.
Will he have the courage to do that? We'll find out in next week's exciting episode of Editing Aloud. Thanks for joining us.